and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 50th anniversary celebrations of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice, at which three U.S. presidents spoke. Gerald Horn, Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, joins us to discuss today's spending priorities on the eve of another war and the enduring guns and butter arguments that Martin Luther King addressed as the war in Vietnam robbed Americans of a victory in the war on poverty. Then we'll speak with Michael Long, a professor of religious studies and peace and conflict studies, and the author of a new book, I Must Resist, Bayard Rustin's Life in Letters. We will discuss this gay pacifist and consummate organizer, Bayard Rustin, who, because of homophobia, was denied credit as the principal organizer of the March on Washington 50 years ago, and his belated recognition by President Obama, who will soon posthumously award Bayard Rustin the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Then finally, following cyber attacks by the Syrian Electronic Army that disrupted Twitter and the New York Times website, we'll look into this shadowy group of hackers who claim they have no ties to the Syrian government, even though Assad referred to them as a real army in a virtual reality. Alan Paller, a leading expert on cybersecurity, joins us to discuss how these hacking attacks are organized and the role of organized crime in cyberspace. And joining us now is Gerald Horn, the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has written more than two dozen books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising in the 1960s, and most recently, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
And the celebrations on the 50th anniversary of the famous speech in Washington, the March on Washington, largely attributed to Martin Luther King, I Had a Dream. Of course, the actual march was about jobs and justice. Did you feel that the issues of jobs and justice came up adequately today, Gerald, given that three former presidents spoke?
Well, generally speaking, yes. I think that the remarks by Mr. Obama in particular spoke to that question. He spoke about the racial wealth gap. He spoke about the fact that unemployment is higher in the black community than in the white community. But obviously, there was a difficulty embedded in his remarks insofar as he spoke rather eloquently about the legacy of August 28, 1963, but no doubt rushed off afterwards to a meeting of his National Security Council where the bombing of Syria is no doubt being plotted for the next 24 to 48 hours. Dr. King spoke of how the United States would have difficulty in enjoying both guns and butter. And 50 years later, we have that same dilemma. It's unclear to me how the United States can address homelessness and hunger while spending billions of dollars on a military-industrial complex, not to mention plotting the launching of Tomahawk missiles into the suburbs of Damascus.
And when Martin Luther King, back during the Vietnam days, brought up the guns and butter argument and made the point that it's a sort of zero-sum game, that we either can win the war on poverty or win the war in Vietnam, and I think most historians agree that the Vietnam War derailed the war on poverty, which remains inconclusive and unfinished. Do you think that that same dynamic operates today?
I'm afraid so, and unfortunately it's baked into the cake. Unfortunately, the structure of global politics to a degree involves the United States, quote, providing a defense umbrella, unquote, for large swaths of this small planet, and that includes Saudi Arabia, that includes Israel as well. And so when it comes to attacking the Assad regime in Damascus, it's not just the White House that gets a vote. It's not just Congress that gets a vote. It's not just the U.S. people and the peace lobby in the United States that gets a vote. the regime in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, has influence, and the Israeli lobby and the Israeli government have influence as well. In return for providing this so-called defense umbrella for Saudi Arabia, for example, petrodollars are circulated into the U.S. economy. We know that members of the Saudi ruling elite are major investors in Twitter and Apple Computer, not to mention Fox News. And so because of the structure of U.S. politics, the United States is pushed towards these kinds of adventures. As former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once said, it's very difficult to have this well-funded war machine without the impulse arising to somehow deploy it on many different occasions. And that's the difficult dilemma that the United States faces at this particular moment.
But if indeed we are the empire, the last empire, and if the president is the Caesar of the American empire, I don't understand why the empire can't get its subject nations that it protects, like Saudi Arabia, to play ball. Because let's face it, it's the Saudis who are funding the al-Nusra Front, who may take over Syria, and that, of course, is a nightmare. This is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization. We are supposed to be here fighting a war on terror with al-Qaeda as our principal enemy. So arguably, both the Russians and the Americans have something in common here, which is Russia doesn't want al-Qaeda to take over Syria, neither does the United States. Yet the Saudis are the ones that have been funding these guys, you know. So how do you explain that?
Well, it's not just the Saudis. As you well know, Prime Minister David Cameron in London is also pushing for an attack on Damascus. I'm sure you heard the remarks of French President Francois Hollande, which basically leaned in the same direction. We know that former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been negotiating with Qatar, the oil and gas-rich Arab country, about being their face of investment in France and in Paris. We know that the Turkish regime as well is very upset with Bashar al-Assad, and they're pushing for some kind of attack on Damascus as well. Given that strong push and given that strong impetus, it seems that the United States will be pushed towards making what it seems to me will be a major blunder, if not a crime, that is to say, attacking the al-Assad regime. And I choose the word crime very carefully because I don't think there will be a Security Council mandate with regard to such an attack, which means that the Obama administration is skating on very thin and questionable legal ice.
Gerald Horn, again, is the John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's written more than two dozen books, and we are discussing the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Justice. And let me just return to that, to today's speech, particularly by the president, where he talked about, he characterized Wall Street rather accurately, where he talked about greed is good and passion is ineffective. And he said this in the context of this prevailing idea that economic growth automatically generates winners and losers. And it's unfortunate we have casualties, but that's just too bad.
Well, what Mr. Obama was sketching is a fact that it's very difficult for many of us to confront, which is that you have a very powerful right-wing movement in this country. You had it in 1963 at the time of Mr. King's speech. That is to say, the John Birch Society was riding high in 1963, just like the Tea Party movement is riding high in 2013. As a result, it's very difficult to get any kind of progressive legislation, or any kind of legislation for that matter, through this do-nothing Congress. A transportation bill, for example, would generate countless jobs and would not only benefit contractors who generally vote for the Republicans, but would also benefit construction workers and would therefore cut into this very high rate of unemployment amongst black and brown workers in particular. But given the strength of the right wing, given the strength of the Tea Party caucus, it's very difficult to get any sort of traction on such a bill or any other kind of legislation coming out of Washington as we speak.
Well, one of the a lot of the placards that were on display today were referring to the recent overturning of the most important part of the Voting Rights Act, the preclearance of the southern states. And it was mentioned by all three presidents who spoke. And it strikes me as a somewhat bitter irony that the American right, and in particular John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in fact, are using, in quotes, the success of the civil rights movement against American minorities by saying, oh, it's all over now, so we don't need these protections. Does that strike you as an irony?
Well, it not only strikes me as an irony, it has struck Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court as ironic indeed. For example, in her opinion dissenting from the Holder case, in which the Supreme Court basically gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, she noted quite sagely that what the Supreme Court basically said was that you should throw away your umbrella when it's raining if somehow the drops are missing you because you're under an all or shutter. And I think that it's apparent, as the press has pointed out, that Justice Robert is playing a long game. That is to say that he is putting forward a very adroit strategy to reverse the gains of the 1960s. We know that affirmative action is hanging by a thread as a result of the University of Texas case that the Supreme Court also ruled on. I should also point out that it is the long-range ambition of the right wing in the United States to not only reverse the gains of the 1960s, but to reverse the gains of the 1930s. That is to say, to put a bullseye on the back of Social Security and unemployment compensation, the other kinds of social democratic gains that arose during that tumultuous decade. And I'm afraid to say that they're well on their way to accomplishing those long-cherished goals.
Well, Gerald Hall, I recall somebody saying to me recently that, you know, it's not that the Republicans want to overturn and destroy the legacy of FDR. They also would like to go after the other Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, the trust buster. And frankly, the irony is that antitrust has almost disappeared, and a lot of the evisceration of antitrust happened actually under a Democratic president, Bill Clinton.
That is true, although I have to say that I was struck by the fact that with regard to the latest airline merger, that the Justice Department has stepped in and is taking a very close look at that particular case, which no doubt will lead to litigation. But like anything else in this country, everything comes back to the correlation of political forces. And right now, one has to say that even though the conservatives did not prevail in their race to gain the White House in 2012, it does appear that they will hold on to the House in the 2014 elections, and there is a distinct possibility, according to the electoral guru Nate Silver, that they will reclaim the U.S. Senate. On the other side of the ledger, we see that the labor movement, which has been the bulwark of progressive politics historically in the United States, continues to be in decline, continues to be eclipsed. That is to say that the sector of the private sector workers that the labor movement has helped to organize continues to diminish, and their grip on the public sector continues to diminish as well, because the right wing has been so adept at emasculating the government and emasculating the public sector as a whole. So I'm not trying to present a pessimistic picture, but on the other hand, it seems to me we have to be realistic as we go forward.
Well, but this gets down to numbers, doesn't it, Gerald Horn? I mean, in other words, in 2008, when Obama was swept in, over 140 million Americans voted. 2 years later, in 2010, in a coup organized largely by Karl Rove and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, with funding, almost unlimited funding, from the American Petroleum Institute, they pulled off a coup, but they only did it because half the people voted in 2010 in the midterm, which was about 75 million. If that happens again in 2014, if the people who showed up that saved us from having Mitt Romney as our president, if they don't show up this coming year in 2014 in the midterms, then what you just said, or what you quoted Nate Silver saying, will happen. So go figure. Explain to me why it is that the American people don't see this urgency that they vote for the president, but they don't recognize that he can't get anything done with these Tea Party people. And if the Tea Party people take over the Senate, then forget about it.
Well, you're making a good point. But as you well know, in the wake of the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on the Voting Rights Act, you had a number of southern states in particular that rushed to change their laws with regard to voting. For example, in the state of North Carolina, there was a monster bill that was passed weeks after the Supreme Court decision that, among other things, helps to make sure that those without proper ID will not have an opportunity to cast their ballot. I'm sure you recall that in the state of Texas, they tried to engineer legislation which said that a hunting license would be proper ID, but student identification would not. There have been attempts in a number of southern states to remove polling booths from college campuses, for example, and indeed to forbid college students from casting their votes where they go to school. Presumably, that is consistent with the Supreme Court decision. We know that the Justice Department is rushing into court trying to reverse a number of these decisions, but once again, they're rushing into courts. They're rushing into courts where the right wing historically, or at least for the last few decades, has held sway.
And that's because we have not elected enough the Democratic presidents, or at least presidents that aren't determined to empower the right, as Republican presidents have, with Justices Scalia, Alito, Thomas, and Kennedy. So, again, it gets down to showing up at the polls and voting in their interest, doesn't it?
It certainly does, but it's just like 100,000 people showing up in Washington, D.C. this past Saturday. That doesn't happen by accident. It takes organization. It takes funding. And if you compare the United States to its peer nations, comparing it to Germany, for example, or even to France or Japan, it's easy to conclude that the progressive movement and the left-wing movement in the United States is much weaker than it is in peer nations. It's also easy to say that the trade unions are weaker in the United States than in peer nations. What that adds up to is a difficulty in shaping the political consciousness of working-class people, of poor people, etc. It leads to a situation where the depoliticizing of great swaths of the United States population takes place, and that, I'm afraid, helps to benefit the right wing and conservative hegemony.
Well, Gerald Horn, is there a note that we can end on here that reflects some of the optimism that's being generated by this 50th anniversary, that change can happen, and even though we have ebbs and flows of progressive movements and then regressive movements and reactionary movements in the United States, any light at the end of the tunnel here?
Absolutely. The March on Washington, despite some weaknesses that took place this past Saturday, was a magnificent display of progressive politics, with the focus on voting rights, with the focus on racial justice, with the focus on the George Zimmerman acquittal, with the focus on mass incarceration, particularly of people of color. The Dream Defenders, who in the state of Florida were trying to press the legislature to move against the so-called Stand Your Ground laws. The Dreamers, the young people, mostly of Mexican origin, who have been pushing for immigration reform. I think there are a number of positive developments that are taking place in the United States, significant developments. I just think that we need more attention to the rudiments and the ABCs of organizing if we are to halt this right-wing advance.
Well, Gerald Horn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Gerald Horn, who's the John Jay and Rebecca Morse Chair of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He has written more than 24 books, including The Color of Fascism, Lawrence Dennis, Racial Passing, and The Rise of Right-Wing Extremism in the United States, Fire This Time, The Watts Uprising, and the 1960s, and most recently, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African-Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the principal organizer of the March on Washington 50 years ago, Bayard Rustin.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.